So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with The Modern Man. A particular welcome to those new listeners amongst you. Hello, people like Lee, who has just emailed me to say, I just want to be a big lame-o and say how much I love your podcast. There is nothing lame about that confession, Lee. You remind me of Maria Pogson, who wrote me a love letter when I was 15, which said, Hi, Ollie, this is really embarrassing, but I like you. Lee continues, I listen to a lot of podcasts and yours has already become one of my favourites. I only started listening about 5 weeks ago, so I've still got all your back catalogue to consume. I envy you, Lee. There are some highlights there amongst our 40 or so episodes. Do check out the Santa Claus interview. I know that was the Christmas special and it's now practically midsummer, but it remains one of my favourites. Whatever the season, it's always a good time to hear a story about Father Christmas being propositioned for a threesome, in my view, anyway. New listeners likely should be aware that as we are a magazine show, the topic changes week on week. This week, our main feature is about corpses. It's about human dead bodies. I have to come right out and say that. That's what we're doing. You know, we do fluffy subjects sometimes. We've done coffee. We've done productivity and shopping. Nice palatable things like that. This week it is about dead bodies. Why? Well, I suppose because death is all around, as Wet 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 never sang. And I think, to be honest, we all too readily neglect to confront the reality of the end of our lives and what happens to our loved ones remains until those issues are forced to the front of our minds when we lose our next of kin. And so I wanted to, sort of away from all of that emotion, just interview a mortician about what she gets up to. And I'm so glad I did. She is a great guest this week. She's a pathology technician, actually, to be precise. And she's absolutely fascinating. For example, she's going to teach you exactly what happens to your body when you get cremated, and also how to keep up a corpse's chin. Now, you will not hear that content anywhere else, will you? Also on today's show, you will learn what spermateria is, you will learn what ledging is, and you'll learn there are a lot more uses for cotton wool than just soothing sunburn. Let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
It was a little bit like he was a phone book that had been ripped in half and so his buttocks were on the front.
Problem solving the dead. How to prepare an autopsy.
Eggs, plain yoghurt, water, cornstarch, and of course, a pinch of salt.
And Alex Fox has the recipe for the perfect ejaculation. But first, it's the man who, 1 week into this heatwave, has impressively still not burned. I always imagined that he would go bright red. It's Ollie Pitt.
Sun cream.
What are the big trends for this week's zeitgeist?
The death of loyalty.
Oh God, don't say that. We're trying to build up an audience here.
Let's talk about J.Crew. I don't know what you know about J.Crew.
I read the men's glossy mags, and they're a brand that are often picked out and sort of presented to me as something that I should buy for twice the price as what I can get in Gap.
Exactly, and they actively boast on their about page on their website that they're the brand that embraces wearing a suit with trainers.
Kind of preppy, aren't they?
Yeah, but they've been having a few problems recently. They've been accused of having inflated prices and that some of their designs are unwearable. People aren't going into their stores. They've got hundreds of stores across the world and people just aren't going in them anymore. And it's being blamed on millennials' fickle shopping habits. Millennials are not interested in brand loyalty. I mean, J.Crew is a brand that's been going, I mean, the name's been going since 1989. But they've been around since like 1947 or something. Mm-hmm. But millennials just don't care. They don't care. They will go with whoever reflects their own identity.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the internet, though, isn't it? Rather than a generational thing, it's the fact that they can now pick and choose from thousands of online stores rather than having to pick an already pre-curated selection of fashions.
Exactly. Well, shopping patterns are dictated by culture, and today's culture is the internet.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what's happening. So what you'd do before is you'd choose a brand, say Adidas, Nike, whoever, and if they sort of, you sort of agreed with their brand ethos, you'd adopt it. You kind of go, yeah, I kind of just do it. I like that. But what's happening now in this pool of like endless choice is that millennials are going, right, what do I really value? What do I like? And they can sift through it all and find a brand that best reflects their own personal identity. They're ditching all the old school brands and going for these new ones that no one's ever heard of before, but that are doing sterling business now.
Like what?
A brand called Everlane. They are exactly the same. They're very similar to J.Crew. In fact, they've been described as J.Crew for millennials. The way that they produce their clothes, from source to costings and everything in their staff and what they pay them, everything is completely transparent. It's a completely open business. So if you buy a T-shirt, for example, you know which factory it came from, you know how much the factory worker got paid, you know the conditions they were in, all these kinds of things.
You know, that's quite interesting because, you know, people often say, as well they should, you know, let's highlight the poor conditions of people who are making clothes for Primark, for example, which get sold for £4. But I sometimes wonder, you know, I bet they're also making clothes for some of the designer labels that are on the high street as well. It's just that instead of selling them for £4, they get sold for £40 when you go into that shop. I'd love to know exactly the supply chain of a lot of the things that I buy, yeah.
On the flip side of that, fast fashion's also doing sterling business as well. So like H&M and all those kinds of brands, because it's much easier to sift through really cheap clothing where there's tons of it, there's tons and tons of choice, because you can still find something that sort of relates to you as an individual. It's not an ethical thing, really. That's just Everlane. That's just one example. It's more about millennials being individualistic.
I have noticed this change, this shift, when it comes to espadrilles. Is that how you pronounce them?
Are these canvas sort of Toms things?
Yes, exactly. Well, you've just made exactly the point.
Yeah.
Toms is the brand, right?
Yeah.
20 years ago, I feel sure if Toms had emerged then as a big brand that people were wearing for fashion, everyone would want Toms. But now they are this product category. I've probably pronounced it wrong. It's probably espadrilles. They are this product category that people go and go, yeah, I got these ones from Peacocks. They're a fiver. You know, it doesn't matter. There's not really, it doesn't seem to me that there's anything cooler about wearing Toms than, apart from the ethics, as you said earlier, which Toms do this business, don't they, of giving away a pair of shoes for every shoe that you buy. I don't think there's any more cool or cachet, really, in me buying the branded ones.
No. And I think it's going to be interesting in the next sort of like 10, 15 years, how many of these sort of established, well-established brands that we all know will cease to be or be struggling.
Yeah.
I quite like that, though. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, it's going back to pre-big brands, isn't it? Pre-globalisation, little boutiques, but on the internet instead of in the villages.
Why not?
What else is hot this week, Ollie?
Bike sharing.
Right.
Have you ever shared a bike?
I think I did a tandem bike when I was about 7 with my dad, because I'd watched that scene in The Muppets where Kermit and Miss Piggy are on one, and I thought, I want to do that.
That does sound like fun. What I'm actually more specifically talking about is things like Boris bikes, although that was bought in by Ken Livingstone. But the thing is with the Boris bikes...
Explain for our international audience what you're talking about.
Boris bikes are named after a mop-headed buffoon.
Quit the political stuff.
Okay, fine.
Just tell us what the bikes are.
They're basically bikes... sponsored by banks that are around London, and they live in little docks. They're like their little houses. You clip them in, they sleep for the night, and you come to them one day.
Jesus, you're so bad at explaining stuff.
What? Do you understand what
I can do this much quicker than you.
Okay.
So,
let me carry on.
In our capital city, there's a public transportation scheme which includes the ability to hire bikes.
It sounds like a passage out of a geography
book. For short
periods
of time. That's it. And then you leave them in a designated place.
You pay £2.
You say anything about politics or banks or docking.
It's £2. You get them all day and you can use them in 30-minute chunks.
Right.
But you have to dock them. And if you don't dock them, you then get charged even more money.
Yeah, because there's no way otherwise is there for the centralised computer to know that you've finished with them.
You go to a place and then you've got to cycle another 150 metres to find a dock. There's nothing there. Then you have to find another one, then another one. And then you've got to walk 3 miles back to where you originally had to be. So
I bet as a millennial,
yes,
you call that a mare.
It's a right old mare.
Terrible.
So,
yeah.
Introducing
yes.
Dockless bike sharing.
So hold on, so it's just Airbnb for bikes, basically?
Yeah, that's the end of this week, like, guys.
No, but is that basically what you've discovered? There's a site that does that, is there?
Well, there was an event called Velocity 2017.
Uh-huh.
And one of the big things that came out of it was this dockless bike sharing. Everybody was talking about it. This is dominating China in Shanghai and Guangzhou. Sorry if I've pronounced that wrong, but I think it's quite a big... It's one of the big cities in China that nobody really knows about. But what you do is you basically pay a subscription and you have access to all of these bikes. And they have GPS little trackers in them and you have an app. And the app tells you where the bikes are, but you can leave the bikes wherever you want.
So how do they prevent them from being stolen?
Well, they have a GPS tracker in them.
Yeah, so you'd know where the person was who nicked them.
Yeah, but you...
But if you're...
But they're so heavily branded, you ain't going to nick it. It's like the Boris bike. If you nick a Boris bike, it's not actually that practical a bike, right?
Because it's not like heavy and it's just designed for urban...
Yeah, it's heavy and it's bulky. It's designed for short urban journeys. You're not going to nick one. And it's the same principle, but you don't have to dock them. And there's 1,000 bikes going out in Manchester, which sounds like a lot.
It's time to bring you back down to earth.
Mm,
yes. Because it's that moment in the show.
Yeah.
Where we see how you've progressed with your challenge to become a true trends insider.
Oh, dear.
You have been tasked by the end of this series in doing the following. Let us know how you're doing. Taking a parliamentary ghost train.
No further.
Tickets to the London transfer of Hamilton.
Nope.
AAA access to a festival.
No.
Enrolling on an elite dating app.
No.
Sitting at the chef's table.
Yes.
Go on.
Minor update is I have made contact with a chef.
Have you been harassing Heston Blumenthal again?
I've harassed multiple people. I haven't got back to him yet. He's just asking me exactly what I mean when I say chef's table, because apparently there's multiple different types of chef table.
I think what producer Matt meant when he came up with this list was that thing where it's in a restaurant where they have a chef's table in the kitchen and you watch the theatre of the food being created and it's really expensive.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, is a lot of them have said, who's paying for it?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because...
Don't know, we haven't thought about that.
Yeah, because I don't think the beer money would be a good use of that.
No, it wouldn't really, no. We haven't been fundraising from our listeners to pay for you to have a £600 meal.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
So I need to figure that out. So what I really need is a millionaire or billionaire to take me out for dinner.
Okay, all right. Well, it's just minor progress.
Just putting that call out there.
But a chef's made contact.
Yes.
Okay. Try the latest cult skincare treatment or product.
No.
Become a Freemason.
I've had further contact from the Freemasons.
Yes.
I'm just gonna say it again.
Yeah.
Said it last week. They're really lovely.
Thoroughly nice guys.
They are so nice. The latest is I've had an email from a guy called Matthew, who is the secretary of the Isambard Brunel Lodge.
Amazing. He's a man fan, is he?
He is a man fan.
God, we've got tentacles everywhere.
He says, I am a modern man listener and also the secretary of the Freemasons Lodge in Watford.
Not too far from me.
No.
If you like it, we could be brothers together.
Well, he said, if you live near Watford, we'd happily start you along on the initiation process, right?
Right.
But he said, you will not get initiated in time for the
initiation. Yeah. He said that last week.
This
okay.
is a problem.
But I want to know more about it. Can you just go for a beer with him or something?
Yes. He's invited me for a beer
in
the hall.
Okay, that's good.
So I think, I haven't actually got back to him yet, so I'm doing it publicly on the podcast.
Fine. Hold Anando's black card. Now, how has that been going? Have you been able to either touch one or meet Andy Peters?
No.
Have you been able to verify that Andy Peters is the man who decides who gets a black card?
I have found a contact, and I can't tell you specifically how or where they are from, because they might get murdered, who knows that Andy Peters was not the main source of the idea of the Nando's black card. However, he's more of a fixer. He helps them get in touch with the relevant celebrities to give the card to. But he is by no means the originator of that idea.
It's still fascinating that Andy Peters is the man that pulls the strings and knows who's cool and who deserves the Nando's black card. So you've got a Nando's mole told you all this stuff.
I cannot confirm nor deny whether or not they worked for Nando's.
Okay. So who did they say invented the Nando's black card?
I can give you a name.
Yeah?
The name is Kerry Perkins.
Amazing. Who's Kerry Perkins?
I don't know. She's the head of PR. She came up with the idea. That's as much detail as I know about that.
Does she still have dominion over who does and who doesn't get to be a Nando's black card member?
Absolutely. And there is a list. Rather than giving you a list of people who are allowed one, I can give you a list of people who aren't allowed one.
Oh my God, this is incredible. Who's on the Nando's black card blacklist?
Kerry Katona.
Ah, you see, that is a difficult brand match. Yeah, I see that.
It's not just that, though. She actually said publicly in an interview that she had one, and she didn't have one. There's an FAQ on Nando's website, and it actually says, if you ask for one, you're not allowed one.
Who else is on the blacklist?
Emma Willis.
Why?
Apparently, a member of the PR team, I don't know who, doesn't like her. Went to school with her, doesn't like her. So she's never allowed one.
And she seems like a really nice woman.
Yeah,
by
she's
the way.
Really nice. And apparently, apparently her agent did actually ask, which now means that she's not allowed them.
That's funny.
Anyway, there were some other celebrities that aren't allowed them now, but only because they asked, right? And that's Greg Rutherford.
Yep.
And Lewis Smith. So they're both Olympians.
The Olympian.
Right?
Yeah.
But Nando's were like, oh, well, you've broken the rules. You can't have one. Yeah. But you're actually really nice.
Yeah.
So instead, they've given them. Wait for it.
Yes.
Chicken checks.
Oh, God.
And chicken checks are a properly... They look like a checkbook, and they entitle you... They're stamped and signed, and you go in with your chicken check, and you go and get your free chicken.
Okay.
But it's not a Nando's black card.
Okay, so that's amazing. You've done some good background research. Are you any closer to being able to touch the card?
Yes. So, the contact had... a black card. This one is now out of date. They're only valid for 12 months.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, his is out of
date. So do they have to every 12 months say, yeah, you're still a celebrity worthy of having a Nando's black card? I guess they do.
There's only ever 100 in circulation at any given time.
Okay.
And he had one. So he has invited me to have my photo taken with said card.
When's that happening?
It was supposed to be happening today, but unfortunately he was busy. So I'm going to be arranging
it. Do we think the Nando's mafia have had him killed?
I'm going to be arranging it.
Covered in lemon and herb sauce.
Hopefully before next week.
And I don't want to end on a damp squib, but, you know, you can't change who you're working with. How have you done in becoming Twitter verified?
Got an email from Twitter, didn't I?
Go on.
Saying that on reflection or whatever that the email says, no.
Oh, really? Why?
Well, I think the problem is, so...
So you filled out the form saying you wanted to be verified and you're a member of, you know, public interest.
Yeah, and there's a box on the form that says... why do you think your account should be verified?
Yeah, I just put because I'm a radio presenter and it would satisfy my own ego.
Is that what you actually
put? I got verified, yeah.
So I put that I got challenged to do it by Ollie Mann and it would really just be doing me a favour if you did.
No, you've got to go back with more arrogance.
I got a response of just, it was just the standard automatic email. Not even somebody from their PR team saying, oh, terribly sorry, better luck next time. Do you know, I mean, I'm slightly deflated. Even talking about it now is making me a bit depressed. I just thought, everybody said, nah, it's really easy. Anyway, on the plus side,
yeah,
there's a hashtag going around saying, get Ollie verified,
okay.
That's been retweeted like 4 times.
Great.
So, you know.
Well, every viral campaign has to start somewhere, doesn't
hashtag
it?
Hashtag get Ollie verified.
Every virus starts with some putrid infection somewhere. I look forward to catching up with that next week, Ollie.
Yeah, me too.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello, Man fans. I'm Sasha Morgan, and I'm executive director of Bold Everywhere, an arts educational charity based in a car park in the middle of Peckham, South London. These are my top 3 Squarespace life hacks on how to run a successful meeting. So the very first thing I'd suggest to people is know exactly what you want to get out of bringing some people together. You'd be surprised the number of times that I've been in the meeting and everyone's looked around slightly vaguely to work out who's running this, why are we here, what are we doing? What's your objective? Do you want some kind of resolution to a problem or a disagreement that's been going on? What do you want and can you visualise it? Because if you can see it, you can make it happen in the meeting. That's it. Okay, point 2, meeting choreography. Who is it that needs to be in the room to make your meeting successful? Don't get confused by titles. It's often not the people with the title that you think need to be in the room. Do a bit of research. Who is it that can actually take action, move things forward on the objective that you have? Also, don't leave it to chance. Ensure that on the date that you have organised, those people are there. Because if there's something about the date that you've chosen that means that those people can't be there, or the circumstances that you've chosen that means that people are dropping out, can't be there, have you booked it in half term? Have you organised it in the middle of a massive sporting event? Make sure that you've created the environment in which the right people can be in the room and that you've communicated your enthusiasm for having them in that room such that they actually turn up. So my final tip is, make sure all the major decisions have been made before you even enter the room. If you think that there's opposition to something that you want to have, get on the phone. Have met with all the key people that need to be on there to do the convincing, persuading, negotiating outside the room. what you want to happen in the room is choreographed agreement. And also, it's much stronger to have another person in the room articulate your perspective without you being seen to bang on about it all the time. How much better for someone else to propose a solution that you want, such that you can be seen to be going along with somebody else's suggestion. So line your ducks up, circumvent opposition well in advance, and make sure you have enough pre-conversations that the conversation emerges in the room seemingly organically, but 100% having been steered by you in advance. So those are my top tips, and if you want to find more about Bold Tendencies, please find us at boldtendencies.com. And here's one more life hack, man fans. Start your own website with Squarespace today with a 2-week free trial and use the code MAN, that's M-A-N-N, to get 10% off.
Now, when did you last see a dead person? I walked over about 100 of them yesterday because I took my son to St John's Wood Burial Grounds, now helpfully rebranded as a children's playground. And if you can just ignore all the old gravestones that are there, they've got a fantastic slide. And that's what we do, isn't it, in the modern world, in the developed world. We tend not to deal directly with death, unless, of course, it's your job. And it certainly is for Carla Valentine, curator of the St. Bart's Museum of Pathology, where I went to meet her. And I started by asking her what first appealed to her about working with corpses.
I tend to explain it like a calling, like, you know, the way some people want to go into the priesthood or some people want to go into the army or whatever. And I just knew that I wanted to be the person that assisted a pathologist. And I knew what a pathologist was because I'd seen Quincy, you know, and I'd seen sort of some things like that. And I knew that they were doctors, but I never wanted to train as a doctor because I had no desire to train for that long. And I had no desire to work with live people whatsoever at all. It just wasn't in my nature. So for me, I was like, if only there was a role where I could help the pathologist, but just be trained in the death aspects of it. And then as I got older, I discovered that there was one. So it was like I sort of, you know, preempted this role before I even knew it existed.
At 9 years old?
Yes. Scary, right?
Unusual.
Yeah. But I had friends, you know, and friends of mine would help me bury animals and we'd have little funerals for them. And that isn't something exclusive to people like me who are interested in death as a career. It's actually something to do with children and their sudden understanding of mortality. It was a kind of way, I think, that we loved animals as well, and we thought, oh, this is really sad, they're just left on the side of the road and we should do something for them. And so we did what we saw on TV. And for me, with the fact that, you know, I was obviously born with a strong stomach, I was obviously born very willing to take on challenges, very astute and wanting to solve puzzles, obviously cared about the dignity of people who died. For me, that just gave me a purpose.
And how old were you when you first saw a dead human body?
I was 7. I saw my granddad die. I say I saw him die. He had a stroke. He didn't die right where I saw him, but he died later in the hospital. Mm. And then the very first time I saw a completely deceased human individual was when I began my year out as an embalmer's assistant. So instead of going off around Southeast Asia or, you know, doing something like that, I decided to go down to Worthing, little town on the coast, and become an embalmer's assistant.
And who was the first body that you saw?
The first body that I saw, I would describe really as a perfect deceased person for an individual who's never really seen somebody dead, because it was a lady who was very old. She'd lived a wonderful life. Her family, you know, they weren't devastated. She died of natural causes. But down there, the sort of demographic is older people anyway. So it was a nice sort of slow, you know, descent into the underworld of the peaceful dead, really, and just learning little bits about death that were very, very normal. Things like rigor mortis, things like where decomposition starts, how you would dress the deceased, how you'd make them look, before then eventually training in much more complex situations.
Where does rigor mortis start?
usually starts about 12 hours after death. So you have what's called primary flaccidity, and that's when you first pass away. And then you can be sort of positioned in any different way. So somebody may murder you and then decide, I'm going to pretend that you died in the chair over there and put you over there. Within 12 to 36 hours, it will set completely, and then it will completely disappear. And then after that, you go into secondary flaccidity, and then you don't get rigor mortis again. So yeah, there's several different stages, and they're all quite easy to calculate.
So if someone's involved in an accident rather than sort of peacefully passing away, when they reach the embalmers, they might be in that stage of rigor mortis, but then you've got the second option of flaccidity to make them look presentable to their family or whatever.
Yes, 12 to 36 hours. And if somebody's in an accident, you know, the autopsy turnaround in most mortuaries tends to, you know, we'll try and do that within a day or so, particularly if it's an old person. You know, the doctor sort of has an idea of the cause of death, and we have to do the autopsy. But if it's an accident, it may take a lot more paperwork anyway. So by the time all that paperwork's been finished, then the rigor mortis tends to start to wear off. While we're doing the autopsy, we can actually help to break that rigor mortis slightly by massaging the joints and things anyway. So then you'd never get a situation, for example, where somebody had died in an odd position at the wheel and then their family had to see them sort of sat up in their coffin, you know, even though there is apparently this new trend for these incredibly lifelike, I would say tableau vivant, they're really tableau mordants. I don't know, have you seen them over in America? People being embalmed, sat up on top of motorbikes, sat up with a glass of champagne and cigarettes. Yeah, we don't tend to have that over here, and it certainly wouldn't happen naturally.
So what do you have to do? There's makeup involved, presumably.
I was only the volunteer, so what I would do, because she was pregnant and really what she needed was muscle, you know, not that I had an awful lot of it at sort of like 18, 19 years of age, what she needed me to help do was to help move the deceased around, help to redress them, help to move her equipment, because embalming involves a lot of pumps and things like that, emptying buckets, because the fluids that are introduced into the body obviously push out the blood. So it was more a case of the heavy lifting and just me picking up tricks of the trade, that kind of thing, while I was with her.
What were the tricks?
Well, things like using eye caps, so they go over the eyeball, because obviously the eyeball can kind of deflate when people pass away, and it can make them, you know, have that sunken-eyed look that you see in so many popular zombie shows. So there's a sort of spiky eye cap, it's a semicircular shape, and once you pull the eyelid down over it, because of the spikes, it won't come back up again, and that gives the sort of illusion of roundness. And
but then, that only works with the eyes closed.
Oh yes, yeah. Most embalmed individuals will have their eyes closed, because the idea is to give the deceased a look of gentle repose. Mm-hmm. Often a stitch or two in the mouth, just to not create a smile. You know, you don't want to make people terrified if the coffin is open at the, you know, a big Joker type smile, but just enough that the person doesn't look sad, that they just look at peace.
And why is that important? I mean, obviously, you know, if your parent is involved in a terrible accident, you don't want to go and see their body and see them looking shocked and scared.
Yeah.
But equally, if they've been involved in something that's happened suddenly, you're not necessarily expecting them to look at peace. Why is it reassuring? Why do humans want that feeling of, oh yeah, he's at peace, she's at peace, when you know that they died, you know,
quite tragically, quite horribly.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's a question that many ask, because bereavement counsellors, I mean, I'm not a bereavement counsellor, and in no way would ever say that I am, but I know bereavement counsellors basically discuss this as a kind of, it's a memory picture, and what they want the relatives to be left with is this idea that they were at peace. In my experience as a mortuary technician, we also do viewings. They're not as common in mortuaries as they are in funeral homes, because funeral homes are meant for viewings. They have much more sort of chapel-like environments and many different rooms, whereas we just have the one. But we would have family members that said, no, we want to see them now. We want to see them as they are. We need to know, because we need to know they're dead. So it really depends on what the family member needs to get from the situation. If they can't believe that their next of kin that they were just talking to an hour ago over breakfast has been hit by a bus, then maybe they don't want that look of quiet repose. They want to see what's happened, because they need to know in order to believe that they've gone. So it really, really depends on what the family want to get out of it.
And do you get a sense of what the person was like from their body?
Yeah, you do. I mean, obviously there are people that are more like caricatures of themselves, for example. So if you're an alcoholic, it's very easy to get a sense of how a person would have been in life, because their shin bones will be covered in bruises, because they will be stumbling around the house all the time and they'll be knocking into chairs and tables, and, you know, they'll probably display a bit of jaundice and be a bit unkempt, you know. And it sounds like that's just a rash judgment, but it's not. You know, you see it and you can put all those pieces together, and this is what takes me back to this idea of, you know, the roadkill on the side of the road, and you can see what's hit them and what's happened and where they've ricocheted and blah blah blah. And then there'll be other people that you can tell that they look after themselves very well. There is such a thing as sudden adult death syndrome. I've dealt with deaths of people, firemen 28 years of age, you know, policemen 30 years of age, just drop like that, and you can completely tell the type of life that they led, and that it in no way had anything to do with how they died, and it was just a really, really unfortunate thing that happened to them, and it's quite sad.
I mean, with children, I can imagine that there must have been times where you're in the middle of trying to do what you're doing professionally, and emotionally it's just been difficult.
Yes. But that's also happened with adults as well. Because, you know, I've worked on the victims of the London terror attacks, the 7/7 terror attacks, various different murder victims, horrendous accidents. So the children, yes, they can be really, really sad, but then so can a lot of the adults. And again, it sort of completely depends on the circumstances, really.
Do you have a sort of internal monologue talking over your emotional reaction to something, saying, but I've got a job to do?
Yeah, it's not as humorous as JD's in Scrubs. I wish it was. But it's more just a case of get on with it. There's a lot of preparation involved in autopsies. Well, I liked there to be for mine. And I focus, you can't tell from my office that I'm usually quite organised, but I like to focus on being prepared.
This is basically an office that looks like Edgar Allan Poe.
Sort of a mixture between the Addams Family House and I don't know, storage hunters, just to paint the picture for everybody. But I think for me it was getting in the mind frame of the sort of preparation aspect. So things like making sure that I had string through my needles, and my needles were taped up on the side of the cupboards, and I had spare blades. And because once you're in the middle of a post-mortem and you've got blood all over your hands, you can't start rummaging around in cupboards looking for this, that and the other.
And you say preparation, but is it a kind of ritual, really?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is certainly a ritual. I think, you know, many APTs have their different rituals, some of them possibly a lot less complex than mine, I don't know. But for me, it was very important that if I was working with a pathologist, because we always work with different pathologists and we had to get to know them all, it's very important for me to know that I was holding out a tool for them before they asked for that. Then that way I was really on the ball and I was doing the best that I could for the deceased, because I was already in the zone. But yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a bit like if a boxer goes into a ring, you know, and has to do the same prayer and kiss his wife on this cheek and then that cheek, and it, you know, there's that element of, if I do the same thing every time, I'll get the same results, I'll get good results. Yeah, definitely a ritualistic aspect involved, I would think.
Talk me through some of the unusual ones then, the problem-solving ones, as you put it.
This is such a difficult question, because with the problem-solving ones, there is a lot that I can give away, which obviously I would never want to offend the privacies of people who are still around, who may know those deceased individuals. But what I can do is I can kind of jumble cases together. So, for example, many of the cases that I did would be people who jumped in front of trains. It's incredibly common. I mean, anyone who lives in London will be very familiar with the term a person under a train. Those cases will all have very similar injuries, catastrophic injuries. And for the most part, family members believe that they won't be able to view the deceased. And it can be quite gratifying and rewarding to spend several hours, you know, reconstructing a person in order for the family to be able to see them. You know, one case I dealt with, it was a little bit like he was a phone book that had been ripped in half, and so his buttocks were on the front, for example. I say one case, that happened several times. Flipping that over just to give him some dignity. I mean, nobody's going to see that. It's not as if the family are going to see that part of his body, but just for his own dignity, to flip that over, to stitch it back in place, to stitch the feet back on, the ankles back on. Skull fracture, we can use some cotton wool to kind of pad out the area, pop some bandage over the top of that so that it looks like the skull's intact. And then the face is still recognisable. And, you know, in that sense, then it's good for the family to be able to see them. if there are eyeballs missing, you know, noses missing, it's a very different story. We would then suggest they wait and they go to the embalmers, who are the experts at actually reconstructing parts of the face and things like that, and then airbrushing the makeup over them, you know, to disguise any joins, things like that. So it would just depend.
And, I mean, can you give us a sense of, you talked about some tricks of the trade earlier with embalming. Mm. I mean, can you give us some sense of things that you do in your daily work that people just don't realise go into reconstructing a body or, you know, opening someone up?
Yeah, definitely things like the usage of cotton wool, which, you know, may seem undignified, but has to be inserted into various orifices all over the body. Simply because once the deceased has been opened and, you know, sphincters have been cut through and there's no muscles holding in any fluids anymore, you can't allow them to just escape into the body bag or into the, you know, the viewing area. So lots of cotton wool has to be used in different ways. And another thing that we all do is a less invasive way of making sure that people's eyes are closed after they've died is to just put a tiny bit of cotton wool in the eyeball and then close the lid over, and then there's just enough friction then in that cotton wool to keep the lid closed. We make sure that false teeth, if they're necessary, are positioned in the right place. I used to clean the teeth with a toothbrush as well, because sometimes you can get sort of various chunks of adipose tissue and fat from the autopsy stuck in there, and it's not very pleasant. And then we can use a sort of special collar, and that collar can then keep the mouth closed, so you don't get that sort of effect that you see on A Christmas Carol, where they used to tie bandages around people's faces, you know, to keep their chins up. Now what we do is we use this kind of a nearly invisible plastic collar to keep the chin up so the mouth's closed. So there are just small things like that.
I mean, most people in this country, I mean, most people in Europe really, only ever see a dead body when it is their next of kin.
That's true, yeah.
Is that a good thing?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's just made everybody sort of terrified of death. I mean, I'm aware that there's a kind of a bit of a movement at the moment, a sort of hipster death movement of talking about it more. And that's a good thing in many, many ways, because the more we talk about death, then the less taken by surprise we will be by it when it comes to our families, for example, and we'll know more about the procedures that we need to go through for funerals. Because that can be one of the main issues, is that funeral directors, you know, knowingly or unbeknowingly, they're dealing with families at a very difficult time. And if you haven't prepared by talking about death or seen a dead body, then you're very shocked and you don't really know what you're kind of agreeing to. So I think the more that we see, the better. But I think there's
obviously... So what does that mean? Does that mean there should be more dead bodies in the media?
Well, I was literally about to say, you know, the thing is, you can't just, you just go, okay, well, let's just start, you know, putting pictures of them all over the place or, you know, whatever. I think one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this museum that I work in is because it's a halfway house between those two things, because it's seeing human remains and contemplating them, but obviously not whole bodies. Gunther von Hagen is doing a similar sort of halfway house thing where he's showing the deceased to people and getting people talking about it, because he's created a sort of halfway house between people being able to look at the deceased, but in a very safe environment, because these cadavers, as it were, have consented to be displayed. They've undergone a process which makes them actually 80% inorganic. They're more plastic than they are human. Mm. So it's a way to open up a discussion about death. And what I think is just an interesting observation of mine is that we do seem to be comfortable with the dead, but only when they've passed a certain level of age and decomposition. So if you can imagine what I'm talking about here is mummies in museums, bog men, skeletons, because they've passed that point of being human. We see that far more than we see bloated, maggot-ridden corpses on the front of newspapers. I think one of the most shocking things that people had seen was the washed-up toddler on the beach in the newspapers. That was probably one of the first times that, you know, a dead body had been shown in the media, and it really caused an outcry to kind of illustrate what was going on with the sort of refugee crisis. So no, I don't think we can't terrorise everybody with bodies, but perhaps we can find these halfway houses, death discussions, and just try and accept it a bit at a time, really.
Now, this show is called The Modern Man. I'm ready to learn. What should we be looking out for in death trends?
Ooh. I think we should be looking out for alkaline hydrolysis, which is what they're calling the new cremation.
Right.
So many, many years ago, obviously, when we used to bury our dead, and then someone, I was about to say, some bright spot came up with the idea of cremation, pun not intended. It wasn't very well received. People thought, good Lord, you know, well, how will we rise come Judgment Day if we're all burned? Alkaline hydrolysis is an environmentally friendly procedure, which actually involves breaking our bodies down into what I can really only describe as a sludge, but it's an environmentally friendly sludge. And at the moment, people are going, oh, you know, really? A sludge? We can't do that. It's undignified. I predict that in 50 years' time, it's just going to be as mainstream as cremation will be.
So you get pulverized?
Not pulverized. It's done with alkaline sort of chemicals, really. So in a retort, in a crematorium, you get pulverized. People may not realize that, but that's how, obviously, the bones are ground down into such fine ashes. Alkaline hydrolysis doesn't involve any kind of pulverizing, and then you end up with a liquid that's safe enough to go, you know, down drains if necessary. You would probably pour that into a woodland burial ground, green burial ground, plant a tree above it. At the moment, definitely we're already looking at people just disregarding coffins completely, or using wicker, or using papier-mâché, so that they can completely biodegrade into the ground. And again, a tree or something will be planted above them, and then that way they will fertilize the soil. It's that kind of quote by Edvard Munch, you know, from my rotting flesh, flowers shall grow, and I'm in them, and that is eternity. And that really, I think, is a sort of natural way. So I think that's what we should look out for in the future.
What are your plans for your body?
Probably what I just described. Not the alkaline hydrolysis, because I think by the time I die, it might not be quite in yet, but definitely just to be wrapped in linen, buried in a woodland burial ground, and then a rose bush planted above me. Because, of course, roses have lots of connections with death. You know, the rose cottage is a euphemism for mortuary. So for me, roses and death kind of go together.
Carla Valentine. And if you'd like to hear more of her stories, and there are many more, do check out her book. It is called Past Mortems. I've put a link up on our website. Alex Fox is up next after this.
It's time for the foxhole, the section that internally I like to refer to as Call My Muff. What have you been up to?
I've been expanding my vocabulary. I've learned some fascinating sexual terms recently. Oh. Are you ready to be tested, Ollie?
I'm ready for the cock glossary, yes.
The first one is actually a term that comes from Victorian times. It's fallen out of use, and it is spermatoria. What do you think spermatoria is?
Sounds like some sort of carnival sideshow that they might have had at the National Exhibition.
It's a little bit like diarrhea.
Ooh.
In that vast amounts of liquid are coming out of you in uncontrollably.
Wow.
It's the idea that in Victorian times they thought that certain men could just ejaculate too much, and it was bad for both their health physically and psychologically.
I mean, I know they did some impressive scientific discovery in that era, but still, is there no sexual activity that the Victorians could ruin with unnecessary prudishness?
Yeah.
Okay, fascinating. What else?
Polysaturated.
Isn't that what was in Flora?
No, this has nothing to do with margarine and everything to do with open relationships. We've spoken before about polyamorous people. Those are people who have consensual, non-monogamous relationships that are committed and loving with more than one person at once. If you are polysaturated, it means that you have reached your absolute limits of how many partners you can manage at one point in time, because you're spread more thinly than a miser's marmite, and you just, even if you do meet somebody else that you want to have a loving affair with, you just can't fit them in. You don't have the time, and you don't have the emotional capacity to manage one more brilliant lover.
Love it. Give me one more.
Well, this is one I've invented.
Okay, don't think that counts as learning words, but never mind.
It
I'm
does.
With
it's
this
a,
now.
It's a neologism.
Uh-huh.
Ledging.
Ooh. So I know what edging is. Well, it's like delaying ejaculation, isn't it?
Well done, Ollie. You've been learning throughout our seasons. I'm very proud of you.
So
yes.
Ledging is doing that on a bench?
No, ledging is, during edging, if you're a woman, it's common to use a toy like a bullet vibrator on yourself. Uh-huh. And then you just pull it away when you're nearing climax, take a pause, pop it back on your clitoris.
Yes.
Ledging involves, during the moments when you're taking a break, using that vibrator on your partner instead. So you're basically swapping between the two of you. It's called ledging because they will think you are legendary for doing that. So you're edging off your own orgasm and theirs at the same time.
There you go. Three new words. Take that, Zaltzman. Let's go on to our listener question of the week, sponsored as ever by our friends at mycondom.com. Alex, remind us of their legendary service.
They sell trillions upon billions upon zillions of different types of condoms and sex toys, including the surprisingly impressive range of 50 Shades of Grey toys.
Okay. Better than the book, then.
I'm sure you've already heard me sigh and watch me roll my eyes about that terrible book. Although, I have to hand it to the E.L. James for starting constructive conversations about S&M. I'll put it that way. Uh-huh. But yeah, the 50 Shades of Grey toys are pretty good. There's one called Something Forbidden Butt Plug, which is ideal for beginners. It's very small, it's easy to clean, it's made out of soft, flexible silicone, so it's really comfy. And they also, at mycondom.com, sell a brilliantly named anal lube called Backslide to accompany it. So yeah, if you want to fertile around your rear doors, then head over to mycondom.com for all the paraphernalia that you require.
Well, our question of the week is actually about condoms. It's from someone who's chosen to remain anonymous, and in this instance, to be honest, I'm not quite sure why. It reveals nothing about them. But anyway, you can choose to remain anonymous if you so wish. And they say, who decides how big the bit at the end of a condom, where the cum goes, is? And why is it that size?
Aha! Okay, we're talking about teats.
We are.
I need to pronounce that very carefully. Yeah. Sometimes we talk tits.
Yeah.
Sometimes we talk teats. Mm-hmm. The teat is the little nipply nodule at the end of a condom that's designed to catch ejaculate. And its size is determined by the average volume of ejaculate that your standard man produces, which, although it may feel like, you know, a skipful when you're in the throes of passion,
yeah,
it's actually, on average, somewhere between a teaspoon and a tablespoon.
Is it? Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's interesting. It's a bit like petrol compartments in cars. You know, you think when you're filling it up, you imagine that 100 quid's worth of petrol is a lot of petrol. You look at a fuel tank, it's a bottle.
You've just managed to make this the most masculine conversation ever.
Does the amount of ejaculate the average man that you refer to produces vary from country to country or ethnicity or anything like that?
Not enough to really affect the size of a teat on a condom.
So they're pretty much the same all around the world?
Yeah, penis size varies. This is why you can get condoms in various different sizes. Some ethnicities naturally have slightly larger or slightly smaller penises. Condoms, for example, in Asian areas tend to be a little on the slimmer fit side, but that's by no means a rule. The reason I'm picking my words really carefully is it's dangerous to make an association that somebody from a particular background will certainly have a penis of a certain size. These are vague trends rather than absolute certainties.
Yes.
But no, in terms of the any variation in the amount of ejaculate produced between men all over the world, there's not a hell of a lot in it.
But do all condoms have these teats?
No, not all of them do.
There are teatless wonders.
There are teatless wonders, yeah. I'm actually a big fan of the only brand I know that make them are Trojan in the States. They're quite hard to get hold of over here in the UK. But they make a series of condoms called Ecstasy, which are tight at the bottom, mm-hmm, tight at the base of the penis to keep them in place. But then they kind of flare out into a sort of baggy balloon shape. And they don't have a teat because the entire condom has enough space in it to catch an ejaculation.
How weird.
Well, this is, I think, particularly in the UK, most people's reaction to these condoms is, a baggy condom. Either is that going to fall off or will that feel weird? Mm. But it's designed to allow movement of the rubber or the polyisoprene, or they're made of various different materials. It's designed to allow more natural movement around the penis. So if you're a man who finds standard condoms too restrictive, you don't like that snug hugging feeling, then these can be a really good option. And a lot of women say that they really like the sensation as well. There's more going on.
I wonder whether maybe that could help to delay ejaculation as well, if the tightness around the head of the penis is something that, you know, gets you coming.
It can for some people, or for others it has the opposite effect, because there's more material moving around. They feel more friction and more stimulation. It's still important with those condoms to pinch the end of them just to make sure that they're not full of air. You don't want loads of air in your condoms. That's a bad thing.
That's just generally a good tip.
Yeah. Of course, there's also internal condoms, previously known as female condoms or femidoms, that we've discussed in previous seasons of Modern Man. That,
and they don't have teats.
They don't have teats because they're essentially like a vagina liner. A woman pokes them up inside herself and then a gent has to aim his penis into the middle of them. They have like a little hoopla ring that hangs outside the bottom. So they add some gamification to sex. You have to aim for the bullseye. But again, lots of people prefer that sensation because it adds more movement and it requires less restriction.
The vagina liner coming soon from Boeing.
While we're talking about volumes of ejaculate, though, one question I get a lot from men is, how can I make myself spunk more? A lot of people.
And that's the influence of porn, I suspect.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was about to say. Yeah. It's definitely people who've seen porn. But what they don't realise is that often what they're viewing on pornographic films isn't spunk at all.
Oh, right.
It's often a substance called methylcellulose. It's a substance often used in cooking that bears an unnerving resemblance to spunk. They might also use something called cum lube, which is lube designed to be more opaque and have more of a gelatinous kind of texture to resemble ejaculate. Or did you know that there's various recipes available on the internet where you can essentially cook up your own fake cum, involving eggs, plain yogurt, water, cornstarch, and of course, a pinch of salt.
Of course I didn't know that.
Come to mind for dinner, Ollie.
If you do want to ejaculate more, though, what is there something you can do? It's just basically abstain from sex for a while, isn't it?
There are all sorts of pills, potions, lotions, and Christ knows what available from disreputable sources on the net that claim to be able to make you produce vast amounts of cum, like some kind of like fire hydrant going off. No, they don't work. There is nothing, no medical evidence to say that they can do that. To optimise your normal human capacity to produce sperm, you want to make sure that you're well hydrated and in generally good health. Taking, some doctors say, taking a decent multivitamin will help to ensure that everything's working perfectly. And yeah, if you haven't come for a while, there's bound to be more. But there's a limit to how much spunk you can make as a man. Nothing that you can drink or otherwise consume from the internet is going to change that hugely, unless you suddenly want testicles the size of watermelons.
So spermatorrhea wasn't real. The Victorians definitely had it wrong.
An absolute load of cum-based codswallop.
If you have a question for Alex's foxhole next week, what do you have to do?
Head over to our website, which is modernman.co.uk, and click on feedback.
And if you want to buy yourself a condom from mycondom.com to make yourself happy and also to thank them for sponsoring this episode of The Foxhole,
please do check them out. Their range is superb and you can get 15% off when you use the code FOXHOLE.
And with that, we've very nearly reached the end of another edition of The Modern Man. There is just time, though, to anoint a new manbassador. It is Jesse in Delaware who says, "Ollie, your show has helped stimulate my brain as I ponder a second career path. I'm currently a male pediatric nurse. Thank you for restoring my faith in global intelligence and wit. Blimey. I hereby pronounce you Manbassador for Delaware." Congratulations. If you would like to be a Manbassador, just submit a review to iTunes or buy us a beer. Details on our website, modernmanwith2ns.co.uk. Our theme is by Django Django. Thank you to them. And our record of the week is by The Horrors. Remember them? This is new from them. It's called Machine, and it came out this week. Told you it was new. Here it is. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. We'll see you next Tuesday.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.